Thank you. I'm going to be talking to this afternoon about an effort. You'll see that both the ASTA and the Biotech Industry Organization logo are on these slides. This is an effort that BIO and ASTA are working on together to make that smooth transition from proprietary to generic biotech events. Well, we just heard from Steve, I'm not going to go through all this, about all the intellectual property that can be associated with seed. The reason I have this slide up here is just to, and I think you can tell from Steve's presentation, it's not as simple. I mean, there's a lot of different intellectual property that can be associated with a variety, both through intellectual property associated with the biotech event itself, and that intellectual property associated with the germplasm. And on top of that, there can be intellectual property associated with, for example, seed coatings. So there's a lot of different layers of IPR that can be associated with seed. And that means, you know, there's been a lot, people have been talking a lot about, okay, we're going to have a generic market for seed. What does that mean? What is a generic product when you're talking about seed? And it's because of the different intellectual property that can be associated with that seed, it's important to remember what we mean by a truly generic product. And that's what this slide is meant to portray. So in the first section of this, the first box, there's the germplasm has a variety patent associated with it. The event has that patent has expired. But this is not a generic product because there's still some intellectual property associated with that variety. The second box, there's a PVP certificate associated with the germplasm. Again, the patent has expired for the event, but again, this is not truly a generic product. The only truly generic product is when there's no intellectual property associated with either the germplasm or the event. And that's what we mean by a truly generic product. So we've heard a lot about intellectual property. And you know, I've been working in the area of biotech for too long. I won't mention how long, but over 20 years or so. And I got to tell you, I never thought, you know, you always thought that you were going to look 10 years ahead and try to predict where we were going to be. And where we are now is you have IPR associated with these events expiring for some of these events. But the one thing we have to remember is these are still highly regulated products. So it's, in a sense, collision may be too strong a word, but you have the IPR expiring, but these are still highly regulated products. And that's really why we're, you know, why the NPGS may have some issues, and that's why BIO and ASTA are working towards a mechanism to try to resolve the expiration of IPR and the existence of the regulatory framework. So I know that some of our speakers later on are going to go into more detail on the regulation of these products, but I think it's still worth my going kind of generally over where we are. So we understand kind of the context in which we're approaching that generic marketplace. So if you look first at the U.S. regulatory framework, we're a little unique. And we're unique because USDA deregulates, and this goes to what question earlier. So when USDA makes its regulatory decision, it is essentially saying that that variety can be used like any other variety in agriculture. That means that that deregulatory decision, that final decision by USDA, it's not time limited. So you don't have to go back to USDA again. Once you're deregulated forever, unless some adverse effect is found. But generally, this is not time limited. The other important point to remember is that for USDA, if you deregulate one event, and another event is also deregulated, you put those two events together through traditional breeding, that stack product does not have to go back to USDA. And that's really an important point to remember, because we are truly unique in that. In contrast, EPA, and EPA, as was mentioned, they only look at a subset of biotech events, and it's those events that are considered pesticides under our pesticide laws called plant incorporated protectants, or PIPs. So all the BT products, for example, come under EPA regulation. In contrast to USDA, EPA registrations are time limited. So you have to come back to EPA, I think it's every 10 years, primarily to, it's part of their, EPA has a general re-registration process for all its pesticides. So the registration is time limited. That registration has to be maintained, and there's a cost associated with that maintenance. And unlike USDA, there is a separate registration for each stack. So you have BT event A, BT event B, you put those together in a stack product, and that stack product has to be approved by EPA through their registration process. And that's primarily because of insect resistant management practices. So let's look at the rest of the world. In just about every other country, authorizations are time limited. There's some countries where that's not the case, but the vast majority of countries have a time limit authorization. That means that whoever is maintaining those authorizations has to maintain the data package to be able to go back to that country and get a reapproval. And just about every other country requires a separate authorization for each stack product. So every time you have two events put together in a unique stack, or two or three or four or five events put together, you have to go back to that regulatory authority and get a new approval. And then the other issue is that requirements among countries, and that the U.S. is included, those requirements are always evolving. And in a sense, that makes sense, because the technology is evolving. But it's not a static requirement. And oftentimes, new requirements come online. The biosafety protocol, for example, if a country becomes a party to the biosafety protocol, often that means that they will be putting into place new regulations for biotech events. There's a significant cost associated with maintaining and getting these authorizations, and there's a lot of, in fact, political know-how that's required to get these authorizations. So the bottom line is these events are really highly regulated worldwide, and that has implications for how we deal with them when they become generic in this country. In addition to the regulatory requirements, of course, you have to maintain proper stewardship when dealing with these products. And that has to do with maintaining their durability, maintaining the integrity of the product, and the quality of that product. And also, oftentimes, there are stewardship requirements associated with authorizations. Insect resistance management is one of them. And then also, stewardship is required to maintain to minimize any trade disruptions. Because these are highly regulated and those authorizations don't always come at the same time, appropriate stewardship really is necessary so that our downstream export grain and food exports aren't hindered. And this also requires a lot of resources and a lot of communication across the value chain. So when Bio and ASTA started our process at trying to look towards that time when patents will start expiring for biotech events, both organizations developed sets of principles. And I'm not going to go through each of our individual principles in detail, but just to highlight some principles that we felt we needed to address as we went through this process. And the first is to avoid unnecessary trade disruptions. I mean, that's a critical point. So approvals need to be maintained. And when I say approvals, I don't mean just EPA approvals, but international approvals need to be maintained, or they need to be sought under those if necessary. For example, if a new stack is made. And then, of course, as I said, proper stewardship needs to be maintained. And then another key principle for both organizations is to respect all intellectual property and to support innovation. And the two go hand in hand. And that means fair compensation for any data package. And that means also, after patent expiration, that there should be access to those events once they become generic to continue to promote innovation. And then finally, we all need to promote science-based, transparent, and predictable regulatory processes. We have a fairly complicated global regulatory system for these events. And some of them have been around a long time. Some of them have been approved in 10 or 20 countries. And there's been no evidence that of any hazard to the environment or to human consumption. So at some point, we believe that these products should be considered generally recognized as safe, essentially. And then another important component to all of this, given that authorizations are not synchronous, governments need to consider low-level presence policies. So this is the backdrop which we have been working, and to develop a framework for this smooth transition. And this smooth transition means working from when a proprietary event moves towards patent expiration and becoming a generic event, and how that transition occurs for maintaining those regulatory authorizations, maintaining the stewardship of that product. How do you build a framework for that to happen? I'm not really going to go through all of the points on this slide because I want to spend more time in how this framework is going to work. But suffice to say, there's a balance. There is a balance between, you know, the transition to maintaining those regulatory approvals with being able to utilize those events once they come off patent. So, and that's really what we're trying to develop, is that balance. So what we've developed is what we're calling the Accord Agreement. We looked at a number of different options when we were trying to develop this framework for that transition of regulatory and stewardship responsibilities. We looked at, for example, what the chemical world does. They use what are called task force to maintain regulatory authorizations for chemical products. We looked at the possibility of the government playing a role. And what we, in looking at these different options, some of the principles or some of the key elements that we knew we needed were we wanted something that was a predictable process. So the framework had to be predictable. We wanted it to be transparent. And we wanted it to, again, maintain that balance of access to generic events and minimizing trade disruptions. And this is how we came up with or developed this Accord Agreement. Now, essentially, this is a contract which anyone can join. Oops, sorry. I'm going to go to the timeline, because I think this is the best way to really understand it. So essentially, if you think of this as a contractual and binding arrangement, and think of it as a box, and anyone can enter this box and get a certain amount of information, and there are different levels in this box and with different responsibilities. So at the beginning, anyone can sign the Accord Agreement. ARS could sign the Accord Agreement. The technology companies would sign the Accord Agreement. ASTA could sign the Accord Agreement. When you sign this agreement, it's a contract, you're really not taking on any responsibilities, except for a couple. If a technology provider signs the Accord Agreement, what that technology provider is taking on, the responsibility they are taking on, is they're saying that they will provide notice over a certain period of time before their patent on a particular event is going to expire. So they will provide notice to all the other signatories to the Accord Agreement that a patent is going to expire, a certain period of time before that patent is going to expire. For example, 3 years before the patent is going to expire. We haven't determined all the specific time periods, so I'm just going to give you hypotheticals here. So anyone who is a signatory to the Accord will know in advance that all of the patents, when the last patent to a particular event is going to expire. So that's one of the advantages to being a signatory to the Accord Agreement. And that's one of the responsibilities if you're a trait provider. The only other responsibility one would take on if they sign the Accord Agreement, if you're already commercializing a biotech event. So for example, if you're a tech provider or any of the tech provider licensees and you're already commercializing biotech events, whether or not they're on or off patent, you agree that you will maintain the stewardship of those products. So we're really talking about minimal responsibilities. If ARS, for example, were to sign the Accord Agreement, they would literally have no responsibilities other than they would get that, they would know that they will get notice when a particular event is going to get off patent. So there's an advantage for an entity like ARS or some smaller seed companies that for them to sign the Accord Agreement. So that's how you enter this box. You sign and you get this initial notice that a patent is going to go off for a particular event. And it gives you a particular period of time before that patent expires. Then there's a next level of agreement. So I'm going to pretend I'm a small seed company, for example. I sign the Accord Agreement because I want to know when patents are going to expire on events, because I may want to utilize them commercially in my own breeding program. Event X, a technology provider, makes that initial notice and says, the patent on Event X is going to expire in 3 years, for example. And I think, I think this might be interesting to me commercially. I think I can see how I could utilize that event in my own breeding program and take advantage of it commercially. But I need to have more information. So I then sign what we're calling a confidentiality agreement. And once I sign that confidentiality agreement, I get more information. But the information I get must be held, confidentially. And that information that I'll get from the patent holder will be enough information for me to determine whether, in fact, this will be useful for me commercially. So, for example, some of the information that could be provided is the status of that event from a regulatory perspective around the world. You know, where is it approved? Where is it not approved? And when will those authorizations expire? Because, for example, if that particular event, all the authorizations were going to expire internationally in a year from now or a year after the patent expired, that would be a certain extra cost for me, to maintain those events as a small seed company. So once I sign the confidentiality agreement, I'm provided with the kind of information I will need to determine whether I want to go ahead and maybe utilize this event commercially in my own breeding program. So let's say I decide I want to utilize this event. But, you know, I'm a really small company, and there's no way I can maintain these international regulatory approvals because it's estimated that that can cost, you know, $1 million a year to maintain those approvals around the world. So this is a huge cost. And, in fact, this is my personal feeling, that if there's any kind of chokehold to generic events entering the marketplace, it's going to be the costs associated with those international approvals. So I'm a small seed company, and I think, well, I really, really do want to utilize this event. Well, under the Accord Agreement, the next step for me is to become qualified. And what that means is an objective way of determining that I have the financial wherewithal, the resources to maintain the necessary international regulatory approvals, to maintain the necessary domestic approvals if it's regulated by EPA, for example. And I can either do that as a single entity, or I can band with other small entities to form what we're calling a task force. It doesn't matter what it's really called, but, you know, we'll form together, and as a unit, we can become qualified. And so let's say I've decided I can't do this alone. So I find, you know, 10 other small seed companies that also are interested in this event, and we band together contractually. There'll be a contract associated with this. And we become qualified as a single entity, as a single task force. The next step in the process will be negotiation with the original patent holder. And we'll be negotiating over access to the regulatory data and authorizations. And, you know, the data package that patent holder holds can be utilized to maintain the necessary international regulatory authorization. And that negotiation will be over the compensation for that data. And there are a number of different ways that can happen. We could negotiate with the original patent holder in such a way that we will take on all those responsibilities. Or we could, for example, negotiate with the original patent holder contractually so that they maintain those authorizations for us, for example. Or we could find a third party to help us maintain those authorizations. But this will be through a negotiation. And if for some reason that negotiation can't be concluded, then there is binding arbitration to the process, so that at some point there will be a contractual arrangement between this task force entity and the original patent holder. And then once that is concluded, at patent expiration, that data, those authorizations, and the event, and this is important, the event also, that's made available or it's transferred to us as a task force. And in that way, both the event is transferred and those regulatory responsibilities are transferred. And it's all done through a series of contractual arrangements with increasing responsibility. So this is really what, you know, the kind of framework that we're envisioning right now. Our hope is that it allows smaller entities to have access to generic events and while being able to maintain those regulatory authorizations. Now, it doesn't mean that there's going to be a thriving generic marketplace. That will depend on the economics of it, of course. But at least what we hope to develop is a mechanism by which it can happen in a transparent and predictable manner. So what are our next steps? Okay, we now have this framework, and we've got most of the key terms for that framework established. So we have kind of the scaffolding of the framework. And our next step is to start developing legal and operational text for this accord agreement. Throughout this process, we've been maintaining stakeholder outreach, both through our downstream industry stakeholders, because they have quite a big interest in this, primarily to maintain those our international markets. That's a big concern of, for example, the grain trade. We've also have had numerous discussions with USDA as we've been developing the accord agreement. And the third step, we're in the process of developing a guidance document that will be used by any entity, and it, be it commercial or not, to kind of let them know what they need to consider if they're thinking of utilizing generic events in their, you know, commercially. And that, in terms of the costs associated with it, what kind of regulations they need, you know, that they will have to comply with, and again, summarizing the accord agreement. So this is still a work in progress, but and it's complicated. Each time, it's like the proverbial onion. Each time we think we've got it all figured out, we peel back another layer of the onion. But our goal is to have this legal and operational text completed by the end of the first quarter of 2012. And that's it. Hopefully I haven't confused everyone with this.